Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. I'm your host, Aisling O'Rourke, and I hope you are safe and well as you tune in. Thank you all for your lovely messages after last week's show. I hope you enjoy this week's episode just as much. And remember, this show is very much driven by you, the listener. So if there is an item that you would like us to feature here on Let's Go Green, please do get in contact with me directly. Go over to midlands103.com, click on the on-air team, you'll see my face and you'll be able to send me an email directly from that particular web page. Well, in the 2 and a bit years that Let's Go Green has been on air, we have discussed on occasion the efforts around mitigating against climate change and changes that might have on our transport infrastructure. And during the course of those conversations, we have discussed people with disabilities and indeed wheelchair users and the accessibility or lack thereof of our public transport infrastructure. Well, the Irish Wheelchair Association has done quite a large piece of research into our public transport infrastructure and its accessibility and design issues, and there are a plethora. And to talk more about what the association has found as part of this piece of work and this new report called A Getting Nowhere, we're joined by Joan Carthy. Joan, you are very welcome to Let's Go Green.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Joan, in a nutshell, what did yourselves and your colleagues in the Irish Wheelchair Association hope to achieve by conducting this piece of research?
What we're hoping to achieve is better accessibility for people with disabilities. And I think if we can achieve that, we're achieving better accessibility for everybody. One of our major problems, transport is such a big issue right across the board, and there's so many different aspects of it that we could speak about and research and explore. But what we did was we narrowed it down to one thing specifically, and that's the lack of mandatory standards that there are for planning and design of transport infrastructure. So in layman's terms, what we're really looking at in that space is bus stops, footpaths, those type of things that are inhibiting people with disabilities actually being able to use transport.
So, do you know, I think what you said there will shock people around there being a lack of mandatory requirements on the design of these pieces of infrastructure, because you know, anyone who's put planning permission together for even an extension to a house or a renovation to an old building or even a new house will know that there are so many rules and requirements around planning that I think most of us would have assumed that there would be rules around that too.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where there's a big ball down in what's happening in relation to the rollout of many of the transport projects that are happening at the moment. So when we look at mandatory standards and we look at the reports that we carried out, there was over 30 policies that were looked into in relation to planning and design laws. And there's actually nothing there that's mandatory. Everything is guidelines, standards, and even the wording within those is very loose. So it's where possible, we shall, all those type of pieces of language is around it. So what happens is it actually leaves designers and planners in a very difficult position. So the blame is not even on them. The blame is right back to legislation and mandatory standards that we don't have. Because if they look at the different guidelines that are out there, some of them can differ depending on what policy that you happen to be looking at the time. And then it's left up to what the person themselves feel is the right design for a specific area.
So and then that would explain why, and sorry for cutting across you there, Joan, but that would explain why in a locality you might come across a different design or layout of the road around a bus stop or a cycle track, or that this is why there are these differences, because there isn't an overall design for them in the system.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, we do have to recognise that Ireland is a very old country. So our cities, our towns and villages have got small pathways, small roadways. And for the more that, I suppose, more cars that are on the road, that in itself is causing an issue in relation to climate change. So it's how we figure all that piece out, but in the best way possible. And at the moment, it's kind of happening very haphazardly. Mm. And in some cases, what it's doing, it's actually going backwards rather than forwards in relation to having people use public transport comfortably and not feeling unsafe.
So then talk to me about the experiences, because I know you spoke to a number of wheelchair users as part of this particular piece of work. And, you know, for able-bodied people or people who have no experience of caring for an individual who uses a wheelchair, these issues that wheelchair users come across on a daily basis, they're probably oblivious to them. Like, let's be honest about it. If it's not in your day-to-day life, it's not something that you probably will think about. But give us an example of the difficulties that wheelchair users are experiencing on a day-to-day basis in using, say, getting the local bus, getting the train. What are the issues that they come up with?
Well, very specifically, I will talk about the buses, I think, first of all, and the rollout of Bus Connects, and then the continued rollout of Cycle Connects and Active Travel, and how all that kind of comes together. And again, I've said this in every interview, we are not pitching people with disabilities against cyclists. This report is very much around the standards and the lack of mandatory standards to keep everybody safe. And what's been rolled out at the moment is unsafe for people with disabilities, pedestrians in general, and it's definitely unsafe for cyclists as well. So there needs to be work done to be able to come up with a design that suits everybody. But to really get the picture across, I suppose, and we have videos up on our social media and our website that really shows how vulnerable people with disabilities can become now with the design of Bus Connect and what we would call the floating bus islands. So if you can just imagine that your bus stop has a cycle lane running either in front of it or behind it, but you have to pass through that cycle lane off your path to get onto a bus island, to get onto a bus. So what you're dealing with is, depending on the time of the day, if it's peak hour, it's even more dangerous. But if you're trying to navigate across a cycle lane where there's no markings, there's no indication for a cyclist to slow down, somebody might have a visual impairment, they're not able to see the cyclist coming up the road, it's hugely dangerous. And what's happening now is people who have been navigating the transport system for years as people with disabilities, they're actually now becoming more fearful. And I know why we talk a lot about people who are wheelchair users, and I suppose that's what Irish Wheelchair Association is most known for, but a lot of our members have all sorts of different types of disabilities. But across the disability community, people with a visual impairment, and that's one of our videos is about, is actually somebody with a visual impairment. And they've had this for 40 years. They've been able to navigate Dublin City in their own way, and they've been able to use public transport and feel quite confident in using it. But now with the cycle lane floating bus stops coming up, all around the place, what's now happening is this particular individual who was working and used public transport for her job is becoming more fearful because she had so many close calls with cyclists. Mm-hmm. Just not seeing each other in time.
And there is an effort to get more and more of us out of our cars, and So to do this, they're redesigning the infrastructure and the layout of it. And, you know, we all have our opinions as to whether what they're doing is actually improving or disimproving the system. But actually, people in wheelchairs, people with visual impairments, people with all sorts of disabilities are actually really feeling disadvantaged as a result of this so-called progress.
Yeah, and I think that's a very tough thing to be dealing with. Transport in itself is generally quite inaccessible for people with disabilities. And with the way the designs are being rolled out, it is making it even worse. We would have a huge part of why people with disabilities aren't in employment is down to transport. And I know rural areas obviously have a different issue as well in relation to bad transport services. So that in itself becomes a problem. But if you have a transport system in place, but it's now actually dangerous or more dangerous than what it used to be to get onto the buses, it's really leaving people with disabilities behind. And as I said earlier in the interview, you know, if you get it right for people with disabilities, you get it right for everybody else in the community. So if you're looking at older people, people with mobility issues, if you're talking about parents with buggies or, you know, a couple of children in tow where you're trying to get on a bus, if that area is not safe for people with disabilities, it's not safe for anybody.
Well, that is a very good point, one very well made. Well, it's an important issue, so stay tuned. We'll be back after the break to continue our conversation around accessibility in our public transport infrastructure.
Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.
You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and we're talking to Joan Carthy of the Irish Wheelchair Association about a new report that has been assessing the design of our public transport infrastructure with a particular focus on accessibility. Now, Joan, this report has been out for a couple of weeks. What reaction have you been getting on it?
We haven't heard from Eamon Ryan, but we do have a meeting with Jack Chambers.
Okay.
And that's coming up quite soon. So we're hoping that we'll be able to get some sort of pathway with him in relation to how we move forward with this issue. It's a legislative piece of work, so it's legislation that we need to change. So it's not going to happen overnight, but we do need it to happen as soon as possible, given the rollout of Bus Connect and Cycle Connect and active travel across the country. We don't want to be in a position where we're looking to retrofit everything. Yeah. And as it is, I really feel very strongly that some of that work is going to have to be done, because more and more as I'm traveling around Dublin, I'm seeing these bus islands just being erected all over the place. So it's quite worrying. It's gone into other cities as well.
And I know, like, even like down around the Midlands, you would frequently see a bus stop on a narrow footpath with a cycle track on the road and then the traffic lane. And in theory, the bus driver's not supposed to pull in at the footpath. They're supposed to pull in at the edge of the cycle path, and somehow the pedestrian or wheelchair user or whoever it might be is supposed to jump from the footpath onto the bus. Like, it seems to me there are obvious design flaws here, and that if what you're looking for, it's not just something that would benefit the likes of Dublin or Cork or Waterford, it would actually benefit the entire country and public transport infrastructure throughout the country.
Of course it would, and it would even go further than that. If we can get these policies changed to introduce a mandatory standard, you're looking at footpaths, you're looking at roadsides, all of those things would fall in under this piece of legislation. So it's not just your bus stops that could change, it'll be the environment around it.
Now, I know there has been much consternation around footpaths over the years. It seems to, over the years of covering council meetings and that, it tends to come up quite a lot. But like, what is the state of play when it comes to access for people with disabilities at the moment around the country? Are things improving in terms of footpaths? Or are you still getting as many complaints as you would have done in the past?
It really depends on where you live and what council is in and who has the passion to do what with the money that's given. So there's all of those things, I suppose, that happen with the local elections coming up quite soon. I know from an Irish Wheelchair Association, we're going to be inviting local candidates in to talk about the issues of, and footpaths are the one thing that comes up over and over again, because it really is the piece that hinders people having access to local activities and trying to get in there in the shops, trying to get up and down the streets, get to the post office, get to work, whatever the situation is. Footpaths and a couple of different things that come up around the footpath issue. It's not only that the footpaths might be broken or uneven or there isn't a dropped curb to be able to get on and off, but it's even the lack of monitoring, I suppose, or policing cars being parked up on footpaths. Definitely during the summer now, it will start happening again where there's outside dining. We all love a bit of outside dining, but when it's actually encroaching on the footpaths and stopping people with disabilities being able to get by, it's a major problem because people then have to come down onto the roadside, and that in itself is dangerous.
On that point, and listeners will know this because I'm quite open about it, I live with invisible disabilities and I've cared for family members who've needed to use wheelchair on occasion over the years. And one of my pet peeves around the efforts, and it is around tackling climate change and trying to get more and more people out of cars, is this idea of pedestrianising whole swathes of a suburb or a town centre and assuming that everybody can walk. And this base, and I'm wondering, like, is this something that, you know, on a practical level, how much sway does the Irish Wheelchair Association have? Like, are you able to influence, because I know you represent quite a lot of people. And are you able to influence government policy on these issues? Because it does seem like, particularly during COVID, that it was completely forgotten that you have people who use wheelchairs, who need to use a scooter, who might have walking aids, who, you know, have chronic pain issues and might not be able to walk long distances. I was in Malahide at one point where I saw an entirely pedestrianised street and it had a health clinic on the street. I'm going, how do people get to the doctor? Like, sick people tend to need to drive as close as they can to the door because they're tired and sick, you know? So how much of an impact can you and your colleagues in the Irish Wheelchair Association have around issues like this?
Look, it's a really good question. And I'd love to say that the answer is we have huge sway. But we don't. We push as hard as we can. But we find that we're talking to the same issues over and over and over again. Bit by bit, we make a bit of change. Some councils are much better than others at listening and implementing, which obviously is the important piece. During COVID, we had quite a lot of meetings with different councillors and different TDs in relation to the outside dining and how that was working, how it was actually not working and preventing people from accessing their own communities, and that thing of, you know, a sense of if we pedestrianise everything, well, then everything will be okay. And the amount of isolation that was felt by people with disabilities. Here was another thing that was being planned that was completely excluding people with disabilities. And what we ask for over and over again is consultation, but more in relation to negotiation rather than just consultation. Consultation always happens when the plan is made, and then they bring it to us and other organisations, or they put it out there to look for consultation. It's very hard to reverse plans because you're actually fighting already. Whereas if they come to us and say, look, this is what we're looking to do, how can we best do it? We don't have all the answers, but we can definitely give you our side of what's needed and our side of the story, to be able to take into account before the design is done.
And call me cynical, but it would seem logical to include all stakeholders when these things are being designed, because it would just be more efficient. You'd get more through the process, you know, if there was less hassle along the way. But that perhaps, Joan, is a conversation for off air. But Joan Carthy of the Irish Wheelchair Association, thank you so much for taking your time to join us on Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. And for listeners, if you go on to the iwa.ie website, the Irish Wheelchair Association's website, and look up the Getting Nowhere report and look at those videos, they're very short, but they're very impactful. And it is really worth your time, particularly if you don't have a wheelchair user in your family or if you don't have a person who lives with disability in your family. I would encourage you to go and spend the time to look at those. It only take a couple of minutes, but they're very educational. They're really well made. And well, let's hope the government takes notice. Joan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Arsene.
We'll be back after the break.
Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.
You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and we're joined now by Colin O'Byrne of Voice Ireland. Now, Colin has been on the show on more than one occasion, but you might remember way back when we got Colin on the show to talk to us about this one little vehicle he was driving around trying to educate us about. Like a truck, kind of a lorry type thing, Colin, trying to educate us about what was coming down the tracks at the time, the deposit return scheme. And now that it has been up and running for over 2 months, I thought it was time we get Colin back on board. Colin, you know, we were waiting quite some time for the scheme to get off the ground, but now that it finally has and we've all started using it, what are you making of it? What kind of feedback are you getting in Voice Ireland around it?
The feedback, and thanks very much for having me on, Aisling. Again, it's good to talk to you. The feedback is mixed, it's fair to say. A lot of that mixed, and when I say mixed, obviously I mean good and bad and some bits in between. The bad bits or the bits that are a little bit more negative tend to center entirely around the fact that some machines don't seem to be working on a regular basis, the reverse vending machines, which is a problem. I think it's fair to say if your machines aren't working, it's a problem. Now, I know that Return, the system operator, they've been on the national airwaves a few times and have had these very questions put to them. Why aren't the machines working? And they say, oh, it's only a few machines that aren't working. Actually, most of them are working all the time. Now, they have access to more data than I do, so I have to take them at the word that that's the case. But I know anecdotally from speaking with people, or people speaking at me, that some machines just don't seem to be working anyway near regular. And that's a big issue because people are having to adapt their behavior to bottles and cans. That's one. And that's no mean feat. I mean, it sounds easy. Oh, it's just plastic bottles and cans. But if you've spent years engaging in a certain behavior, you know, most of us can't just flick a switch and turn around. Mm-hmm. Like, we've been recycling these items and now we're told to put them aside and bring them somewhere else. That's a change in behavior. That takes time to bed in, and that's fine. So people are getting their head around that. They're also paying their deposit. And then in some cases, they bring these bottles and cans. They've carried out their end of the bargain, right? They paid the deposit and they're bringing things back. And the machines are working. They go, okay, right, look, every machine has an off day. And then they may go the next week and do the same. And the machine isn't working again. And I know, I can't say that this is all across the country because Returns say that it isn't. But anecdotally, I'm hearing in some places that it is a bit like that. And my own experience, where I do my shop, one of the places the machine is working all the time, till I split my shop in two different outlets. And the other place, I've seen it working once in the 9 weeks since the deposit return scheme has gone on. So some of the reverse vending machines, and I should say people don't always know that there are six different vendors, so six different producers of these machines. Some of them seem to be working fine the whole time. Others seem to be glitchy as all hell. Okay. And that's an issue.
And I do think that, look, we are paying to use this service. We're paying extra. And I don't care how, I know it's only a couple of cent, but we're still paying for it.
Exactly.
So it's the principle of the matter. These machines should be working.
They should be, yeah.
Now,
that's what they're designed to do.
Yes.
That's it. That's their sole purpose in life. Now, it is very complicated. There's lots of different shapes, bottles and cans and all that grand. But that's why they get charged big money, because they take into account all these different sites. But that's literally their job, to read the barcodes and send information back. That's it.
And like I've said multiple times on this particular show, even like if I just, I said it out loud, I lived in Germany as a teenager for a short space of time to improve my German. I was very, very lucky to do that. And the deposit return scheme was already there for a very long time. It was part of the weekly shopping experience there. We went to the supermarket with whatever it was. We deposited them there. We got cash back. I still have an issue, I have to be honest, with this idea that I have to spend the money in the supermarket where I return them to. I'd much rather cash back because I just think it'd be much more convenient. And also think it would encourage more people to do it. But that's, you know, my personal opinion. These systems have been up and running around the continent in particular for multiple years. And it is great. Like, I know there will always be teething problems. It is great that we're finally getting it here. But one of the things that I have to say has surprised me around it is the labeling. So I'm a fan of a particular soft drink. And it is very, very clear. Like, it's got a large return me stamp across the bottle. It's also got the round ER, the return symbol. And it's very clear and very easy to use. But when I've been out in the shops, been looking at other brands where, well, you'd kind of need a magnifying glass to see some of the labeling. And that surprised me, because I kind of assumed there'd be some standard that they'd have to adhere to. And I'm just wondering how that process worked, Colin.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you. It should just be, as you said, same standards, same size, same logo everywhere. And this is one of the things that I found annoying was, in advance of the scheme coming out, we were told the bottles and cans that have this logo on it are part of the scheme. The ones that don't are old stock and there won't be a deposit. And that's the demarcation. Simple, one or the other. And it turns out that that wasn't quite right either, that there were some cans that didn't have that the return logo that were part of the scheme. Then other people were being charged deposits, but then weren't getting the deposit back and the return logo wasn't there. So these are all, like you mentioned, teething problems. I was expecting teething problems too. I wasn't expecting that kind of issues with labeling. I don't want to underplay how from a production point of view and cans being produced and printed, how difficult that is, and updating systems to accommodate all of that. But again, it's part of the process of getting the scheme up and running. I will say that all of those issues, annoying though they undoubtedly are, will be done with come June. By the end of May, all old stock is out of the system. All stock of bottles and cans from that point on will be part of the deposit return scheme.
Okay.
So yeah, it's not ideal, but it should be a thing in the past, because all these cans and bottles will only be part of the scheme. Every one you buy will be part of the scheme from the beginning of June on. No old stock, no messing about, all deposit return scheme.
And then the other thing that I've heard anecdotally, a member of my family was going in to use the machine, and the woman in the queue ahead of them was attempting to return a plastic milk bottle. And yes, and I think there is confusion around which drinks vessels are part of this and why they're not. And I suppose, like, you know, why the machines have been designed to take a certain shape bottle, but there are lots of plastic bottles that take even washing detergents, you know. So why was it decided that it would just be what we would colloquially call soft drinks?
Yeah. So there's a whole thing with milk and the cleaning of milk and safety issues associated with milk being left in a container for a long period of time relative to sugary drinks and soft drinks. So milk is a whole different area of health and safety. There's probably a team of 50 people in Brussels who work on nothing more than milk, at least. So it was just decided from a health and safety point of view, from a packaging point of view, milk can do all sorts of queer stuff that soft sugary drinks just don't and won't do. Also, milk tends to come, if you're buying it in a 2-litre or whatever, in a different kind of plastic to the plastic we use for soft drinks. It's called HDPE. The stuff we use for the soft drinks is PET, polyethylene glycol. I'll just say polyethylene. I can't. I never.
PET is grand, Colin. Don't worry about it. PET is absolutely fine.
Of the 2 liter, is great. It's and you'll know when you squeeze it. It seems lighter. It's not as good a quality as PET. PET is a better quality plastic, and will be recycled for a longer period of time than HDPE. Now, from Voice's point of view, we would love to see, you know, glass bottles all over the shop, such as when I was a child, and then being collected for reuse. Like, who knew that the milkman was the very height of circular economy when they were going around, you know, in their gas-powered truck with glass bottles? And yes, that's exactly what we'd love to sort of see again, because you use a glass bottle, you put it out, it's collected, and that's it. It doesn't go in the bin. It's reused. It's washed. So I'm jumping ahead of myself there. But
Yeah.
And that's the deposit return scheme. It fosters not only conversation when it's up and running properly. It fosters conversations not only about the circular economy, but confidence in the fact that this can be done, the fact that we used to do it, and there are other systems in Europe that, in addition to the plastic bottle and aluminium, they also take glass bottles.
Okay.
We have a good collection rate for glass bottles here in Ireland, but the thing is, when they're collected, they're all crushed, smashed down into cutlet, then put under a tremendous heat to reform them into glass again. You know, that's fine, but again, so much better. Like when you were in Germany, they'll have standardized glass bottles there. They're taken away, washed, put out again, producers use them again. It's just a common sense approach to packaging.
And like this is wonderful. And I know there'll be some people listening to this going, it's ridiculous. We were told we needed to do this, this, and this. And now we're told that that's wrong again. Well, like that's evolution. You know, we make mistakes and we learn along the way. And we try each day to do that little bit better with this. And that is, I know that's a simplification of what we're trying to do, but that is what we're trying to do with this.
And a good example of that, actually, sorry to cut across you, is if you look, I'm sure it's the same in other parts of the world, being from Dublin, if you look at pictures of Dublin from the 20s and 30s, you'll see tram lines running all over the place. There were trams everywhere, you know? And then as we became more modern, up with them old tram lines, don't need them anymore. They're the past, you know? So
I was only saying to somebody very, very earlier on this week, I was only saying to somebody the other day, my grandmother went to boarding school and she ended up outside of Mull, but she grew up in Horsleap in County Offaly, and she used to get the train to Banagher in County Offaly. Like that, the idea of a train service going from north to south in the county, like nowadays, is unheard of. You know, the public transport system my grandmother worked with is light years ahead of what I experience now. It's quite bizarre, really. But to return to the return scheme and the is there any plans to extend? Okay, so fair enough. If we take it that we can't have milk as part of this because of the health and safety risk, and quite frankly, like when milk goes off, the smell is awful. So, you know, and these machines are in supermarkets, so you don't want to walk in and smell the stench of gone off milk. What about other types of bottles that, like, say, the likes of detergent or other plastic bottles that we will see in supermarkets that, you know, as we begin to look around, and I think this is the effect of the scheme, that as we begin to look in our own lives, God, that's a plastic bottle. Why is that not in the scheme? Or, you know, there's a bottle of soy sauce. Why is that not in the scheme? Will we see, do you think, an expansion of what's included?
What we're in now is phase one. And I think the way the powers that be are looking at it is in different phases. Phase two or phase three, I'm not sure how concrete these are. But what I've been told is, they will be looking to get glass bottles into it. So as currently constituted, I think Return will be more than happy to see the scheme not really go beyond where it is now, sort of keep us locked into single use, which is something we really should be trying to get away from. Like, we should be trying to move forward by going back, you know, back to the future, by like looking at reuse and how do you make reuse easy. So there is a case that the machines will allow different containers be collected. Will they do that? That's a question I can't give you a good answer to. I can go off for hours and still not give you a good answer to that. That they can, yeah. That they should, not so sure. I mean, I would just love to see supermarkets moving away where if you wanted your fabric conditioner or whatever, it was just the big vat of it and you just brought your bottle and filled it up and away you went again. And that just makes sense to me. I think that you'll see more of that, like these shops, reuse or refill shops are popping up everywhere. And they're great. I just love to see their mainstreams. In France, they've passed.
Well, we had one in the Midlands and it's gone out of business now. So, you know, it's a hard one to sell when it's not. You need it to be at the level of Dunnes and Tesco's and Super Value. You need that scale for that to be profitable.
Yeah, and it has to be easy to engage with. Like people would, loads of us want to, oh, I'd love to do that. This, but if it's not easy to do. Like everyone's got a lot of stuff on. We're busy. You have children to feed.
Oh, sure. Look, I'd love to go into my big supermarket that's near me and buy 3 or 4 carrots and not in a plastic bag. But, you know, at this point, pigs might fly first.
Yeah, exactly. So it's about mainstreaming these things, making them easy for us to use. And I think we do that. We see big refill vats in stores and people use it. And it's clean and simple to use. And maybe even that there's a cost reduction because you're not buying a new carton, you're reusing an old. These are the kind of initiatives that you will lead to success. Whether the deposit return scheme will take anything outside of beverage containers, I don't know. Again, like I said, there's whole units set up in Brussels to argue against such things, and there's other units to argue for such things. Mm-hmm. And they keep all those people gainfully employed. And maybe they never want to reach a resolution of that.
I have to admit, when I did the return for the first time, I did feel a bit like the walk of shame because I had been collecting them for a while. I was like, there's no point going in and out doing this. You know, I collect them for a while. I get a couple of euro back. But I was walking in with my big bag of cans and if you wanted to judge me, well, you had plenty of time to do it, put it that way. So I personally prefer that these machines were in a bit more discreet location, but you know. I currently don't have
it. One is airing one's dirty laundry, so to speak.
Exactly. That's exactly how I felt. It did feel like I was bringing in a bucket of laundry to the supermarket. But, you know, it is what it is. And look, as we say, once we get to the 1st of June, all the old labelling is out of the system. And hopefully by then we will have all the machines working efficiently.
All the machines working. Plus, there'll be a ganzy load more machines coming online as well. So there's more machines. So there'll be more machines. There should be absolutely no excuse for those machines that are acting degenerate to still be acting so. There should be like, I have a last return. Is there any review mechanism? Like what are the terms of contract that the machine operator, if they're not working correctly, like are they reviewed? Are they penalized? Do they lose their license? They haven't got back to me on that yet, but I'd like to know about that.
And I think we should give a shout out to the supermarket staff who are being given out to by the machines not working. And it's not their fault. You know, it's nothing to do with them or their job. There is a rumour in my particular locality that I hope comes true. And that is that the local petrol station will be getting a deposit return scheme. And I'd love to be able to contribute towards putting the petrol in the hybrid. You know, that would keep me content. But listen, Colin O'Byrne, we're running right out of time here and we need to get on to the next item on the show. But thank you so much for joining us as always. And we were very grateful that Voice Ireland always come on the show to talk to us about the topical issues. So thanks very much for your time. And sure, perhaps we might check back in with you in June and see if all those machines are in fact up and running.
Please do, Aisling. Thanks very much for your chat to us.
We'll be back after the break.
Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.
You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. And before we wrap up this evening, we're going to Switzerland to a very interesting court case, quite frankly, an historic court case taken by a group of older women against the Swiss court. They took Switzerland right up to the highest human rights court in Europe over what they said was Switzerland's inaction on climate change. The group is known as Klima Seniorinnen, that's Climate Seniors. And to tell us all about this court case, we're joined now by the environmental correspondent with the Irish Independent, Caroline O'Doherty. Caroline, you're very welcome back to Let's Go Green. Tell us, what was this court case all about?
But as you rightly say, look, the European Court of Human Rights, you don't get there on your first step. there's a long process. You know, you have to go through this preliminary procedures, you know, go through your national courts first is usually the first step. And only when you can't get satisfaction there, then you're allowed, generally speaking, to take your case, try your chances at the European Court of Human Rights. And even then, they'll put you through all sorts of preliminaries. Is it admissible? At what stage? You know, and many, many cases fall. So only a very small fraction of cases even get to what we call hearing, and get to hearing before the Grand Chamber, which is 17 judges representing, you know, they're picked from the different members of countries that actually support the court. And there's about 46 countries who support the European Court of Justice and who are signatories to the European Convention on Human Rights. So once you've got there, you know, that's when your case begins. Okay, but there's so much work has gone on before that. And particularly when it's a case like this, because the European Court of Human Rights has never dealt with climate cases before. So you have a first. This is uncharted territory. There wasn't a path to follow.
And this, as you say, and it is, and it's a group of seniors, you know, so who, you know, and like not wanting to be in any way ageist, but time is very precious the older we get. Like I firmly am of the belief that aging is a privilege because not everybody gets that privilege. But Caroline, what was there, like in a nutshell, because I know these court cases have multiple documents and all of that, but in a nutshell, what was the case that they were putting forward? What did they accuse the Swiss government of?
They said the Swiss government was not doing enough to act to reduce emissions and mitigate against climate change. And as a result, them as citizens of Switzerland, their human rights were being breached because the impacts of inaction is climate change. And climate change was evident in Switzerland, extensive heat waves, increasing heat waves. They're also losing their glaciers, all sorts of issues there, wildfires and so on. And it is a well-proven medical fact that older people are among the more vulnerable groups of society to climate change, and particularly heat waves. Older people, people with underlying medical conditions, and often those two categories overlap, and children and infants. So they were very proud of the fact that there were older women taking this case. That was the grounds of their case.
It's a phenomenal success story in that they were able to fight this case. The powers that be in Switzerland, of course, will now have to go through this judgment. But listeners to this show might be wondering, well, that's all very well and good, but why are you talking about it on a local radio station in Ireland? What does a ruling like this really matter?
Because it matters because this highest court, to which Ireland is a member and a signatory, said, yes, you're right, Switzerland is not doing enough. And that was an incredibly powerful ruling. Now, interestingly, what they did say is there's about 2,000 women represented by this group. So they said, and the broader issue, is Switzerland doing enough? No, it's not. So that is a breach of human rights. Now, four of the women came forward as kind of named members and said, as individuals, are our human rights being breached? And the court actually said no. And it's a really tricky thing to prove in the court. How do you prove a direct link between government inaction and you as an individual being hurt? And the court acknowledged that that's a very high threshold to breach, to prove. But they did on the broader issue of a country failing to do enough on climate action, and that being a breach of human rights. They established that. And that has implications for all 46 other countries, including Ireland. So that we fought that unusually, even though we were not mentioned in that case. We had an interest as a member of the European, as a supporting country of the European Court of Human Rights. And we actually sent a legal team when this court case was heard to question these women and oppose these women. That's how strongly we felt about it, because we, as I say, our country, our government, are representing Ireland, because of that fear that, well, could all our citizens suddenly take cases against the government for failure to enact insufficient climate policies? So that shows you that there is a knock-on effect. And since this court ruling last week, other legal experts have come out and said the same. This is very, very significant, not only in the 46 countries, but even abroad. I've had contact from American human rights groups who are saying, can we talk to you about this? Because this has implications for us, because human rights law tends to be international, even though this is kind of a regional agreement. They tend to influence each other, and a case in one part of the world can often have a knock-on effect on other cases.
And we should say, for listeners' benefit, because I think it's fair to say that our government has been particularly quiet about this, because this happened on Tuesday and something else happened this week. We got a new Taoiseach, or in the last week, I should say, we got a new Taoiseach. So all the attention really on a government level was on the election of Simon Harris as Taoiseach. And we've been, you know, even though we did object to this court case, we've been very quiet on the result of it. What do you think, like, can we expect anything as a result of this here? Will the government now have to look at its efforts in terms of climate change? Because there's a lot of talk, but whether or not there's enough action is up for debate.
Well, interestingly, one third of the government, as in the Green Party, as represented by Eamon Ryan, the Minister for the Environment and Climate Change, he actually went on social media and welcomed this ruling, which did spark some comment because it, well, Ireland Official, Ireland Inc., Ireland, as represented by the three parties, opposed it. So that does show, what does it show? Maybe a slight difference in approach between the three government parties. They will absolutely be all over this ruling. They will be absolutely all over it because the government has faced climate litigation in Ireland before. Ireland was the second country in the world to take a climate case. And that was in 2019, and the ruling was in 2020, if I'm right. And that was Friends of the Irish Environment going after our lack of a proper climate action plan. We've had a couple of climate action plans in the last few years. They've been very detailed. They've had specific targets on how much emissions should be reduced and what action will achieve so many emissions and reductions and so on. Before that, even though we had a law saying we had to have a plan, we had a plan that basically said, yes, we'll reduce emissions, and absolutely no detail about how it would be done. So you can be absolutely sure the Attorney General is all over this and his team are trying to work out what the implications are for Ireland potentially.
And you know what? It is quite inspirational that this group of, okay, 2,000, it's a large number, but still a relatively small group in the scheme of things, has had this impact. This will go down in history. And I suspect if they've been determined enough to fight the case for 9 years, they're going to be following the action that follows as a result of this court case. Well, Caroline O'Doherty of the Irish Independent, thank you as always for joining us here on Let's Go Green. I'm afraid we are right out of time on this week's episode of the show. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned to Midlands 103, and we'll be back same time next week here on Let's Go Green.
Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.